I'm Spencer Williams, and this is All Access Pass.
It was a climb to the gate, but I needed a change. Despite your begging and your pleading, my mind remains. I won't ignore that minor voice that says, just walk ahead. And that's why I choose to run. I can't lay my bed. Responding face again, I hold to the power of now, the beauty of when. It was a climb to the game, direction unknown, towards sky, towards fear. So far from home, I carry all I own, I roam alone. I carry all I own, I roam alone. I hope I never see your despondent face again. I hold to the power of now and the beauty of when.
Hello, and welcome back to the All Access Pass. We're broadcasting from CITR 101.9 in Vancouver on the unceded territory of the Hookaminam-speaking Musqueam people. This show has been created by the Access Collective at CITR, that's us, and tonight we're airing the second episode of the show, which has been newly named All Access Pass. So just to give a little explanation about what our collective is, if you didn't listen last week, the Access Collective aims to explore issues of equity and accessibility for people with diverse cognitive and physical abilities. And on All Access Pack, we talk about shh that matters and give an inside look into awesome people and their abilities. We also seek to include people of all abilities and backgrounds in the production and programming of our weekly show. We don't just want to talk about accessibility, but we want to make radio super accessible to everyone. So over the next hour, the show will include a follow-up on last week's topic of mental health initiatives on campus, including a review of Thrive Week, and an interview with Miranda Massey on mental health first aid at UBC. After that, Spencer's going to talk about the accessibility of music venues in Vancouver and share some of his own personal experiences. So starting off with Thrive Week, Thrive was a week-long series of events. They were based on building positive mental health for students, staff, and faculty at UBC and took place all last week. Thrive is just another example of the movement towards destigmatizing mental health and bringing it into the spotlight on campus. We saw the example of Jack.org last week when we interviewed Maddie Wood. So it's cool to see all the different things that are happening. So when Thrive happened last week, comprised a lot of different events, and that included art exhibits, walk and talk tours, free yoga classes, residence dining hall initiatives, meditation, pet visits with therapy animals, and a huge variety of workshops. From what I heard, it was a real success and awesome event, and we'd love to see it happen again next year if that's possible. Up next, after our song, we're going to carry on the topic of mental health with an interview. Spencer, what's our next song?
Here's another here's another past winner of the Peak Performance Project, Here's Rika with Blackie.
Was Rika with her song Blackie, and now I'll throw it to Madeline, who's going to introduce the interview that she did earlier today.
Hey everyone, my name is Madeline Taylor. So earlier today I interviewed Miranda Massey, who is the Health Promotions Coordinator here at UBC, and she was telling me about a new initiative that's through the same body actually that made the Accessibility Collective at CITR possible. It was the Equity Enhancement Project, and they're the project that the Health Promotions people at UBC are doing is called Mental Health First Aid Project. So they're doing all kinds of cool training with administrators and upper level staff at UBC around being first responders to issues of mental health and mental illness. So here's that interview, and we'll be back in about 20 minutes with more from All Access Pass.
My name is Miranda Massey. I am the Health Promotions Coordinator at UBC. I work in human resources, and my role is really around programming, implementing events and activities, and engagement for staff and faculty around their health and well-being.
So I approached you initially to ask questions about the Mental Health First Aid Project. Can you tell me what is the Mental Health First Aid Project?
Sure. So it's a little bit twofold, I suppose. Mental Health First Aid itself is an internationally recognized and evidence-based mental health training program. It was initially developed in Australia, and then now the Mental Health Commission of Canada has adapted and adopted the information to create a comprehensive training program here in Canada. And the project that we're doing on campus at the moment is through the Equity Enhancement Fund. So what we did was put in a request for funding to hold about 5 different mental health first aid training courses across campus over the span of a year. Normally, we would only be able to hold one with our own department's funding. So we asked for funding for to host 5 altogether, which would allow 125 staff and faculty to go through this training program in the hopes of really expanding the knowledge base on campus when it comes to mental health literacy and being able to approach specific departments and units on campus who might be in a slightly higher need of having this type of expertise training.
So which faculties, for instance, would you be approaching that you consider in greater need of this training?
Yeah, so I worked with Patty Hamler in the Vice President's Students Office to kind of do a bit of an assessment in terms of which staff and faculty on campus are working really in those direct face-to-face and front-facing service roles with students. So we are offering 2 trainings to staff and faculty in the VPS portfolio, so the Vice President students. So that includes advisors within faculties, enrollment services professionals, any of the student development and service workers, and student health as well, and lastly, residence life.
Was there any kind of an event or what was the impetus for expanding this project at UBC?
I think really the interest that we've had from people, particularly over the last few years, there is a lot of talk around mental health. It's becoming something that is easier for people to discuss, not just on campus, but, you know, sort of in society at large. There's still a lot of issues around understanding, around stigma, around misinformation. And what we were hearing from staff and faculty on campus is that their own well-being was being impacted and they were becoming increasingly stressed with not feeling equipped to deal with potential situations involving students and colleagues that might arise with respect to mental health. So in my role, being that it's my audience as staff and faculty, we were looking for a way to really try and arm them with as much information as possible to reduce that stress so that if there was an incident or they were concerned about a student, they really felt like they had a toolbox that they could go to for what the next steps were to take.
Right. Is the hope that from training educators and administrators and staff that then that knowledge will trickle down through the student body as well as the people in charge are more and more equipped to deal with mental health issues?
Absolutely. That would be the hope. I also think that the role modeling that will come out of that or that can hopefully come out of that, if students start seeing their professors and start seeing the staff that they're interacting with on a daily basis using appropriate language, talking about things and definitions in a way that is welcoming and in a way that sort of allows everyone to feel a part of our campus community and feel like they have a place regardless of what their mental health status might be, and really role modeling those healthy behaviors to keep all of us looking after our own collective mental health.
Do you find that indicators like language are some of the easiest ways we can mark progress in terms of accepting mental health as a legitimate health issue for so many people?
That's a really interesting question. I think language is definitely part of it. I think I tend to use physical health as a comparison a lot of the time because we talk about physical illnesses, we talk about physical injuries, we talk about our physical health. It's something that's quite visible. We can see the progression of, let's say, a broken leg from the time that it happens, if someone's wearing a cast, if someone's on crutches, through to maybe the removal of that cast and then physiotherapy and the healing sort of process. Whereas when it comes to mental health challenges, we can't see that as community members. We might not necessarily be able to see that by looking at someone. And so I think that I tend to use comparisons that way and draw parallels that way so that when people, again, are thinking about their health, there's so much out there around physical health. And we talk about that a lot. Even I compare this mental health first aid program to CPR. CPR is incredibly well recognized. It's, you know, they do it in schools. It is something that people know we need. There are jobs that require it in order to take on roles. And what I would love to see is this mental health first aid really elevated to that same level. And language definitely, I think, plays a huge part in that.
So what are some of the things that they focus on in the training program?
Definitely laying the foundation at the beginning around some language pieces. So looking at the difference between mental health and mental illness. Those are terms I think that people still either think are the same thing or really don't understand what the difference might be. So they look at it on a continuum where we have mental health and you either have a really, you know, you're having high mental health at the moment or maybe low mental health at the moment. And then on the other continuum, you have mental illness and maybe you have a low instance of mental illness or no mental illness, or you are living day to day with a mental illness or a mental health challenge. And that those two things exist separately. Someone might have a mental illness and be living with that day to day, but they might have really high mental health and be functioning very well in terms of their mental health. Or anywhere sort of along those different axes points. So that's really the foundational piece. And then it goes into substance use disorders. So looking at overdose. Then it goes into mood disorders. So looking at depression and suicide. Anxiety disorders, panic attack, and acute stress. As well as resources, as well as the last piece, and some of the psychiatric disorders, so psychosis. And so looking at those really acute instances of how might we be able to triage something like that? How might we be able to respond if there was a crisis situation that occurred?
So going back to mental health versus mental illness, can you give me an example of what might constitute someone who is living with a mental illness but experiencing high mental health?
Sure. So let's take the example of someone who might experience higher levels of anxiety and maybe even with some panic attacks or some type of panic disorder that's in there. Anxiety is very prevalent. I think folks, especially on an academic campus, there are levels of anxiety out here, whether they're diagnosed or not, due to sort of the high academic and competitive environment that exists. So I think if there was someone that was living with anxiety on a regular basis and yet they were looking after themselves by getting enough sleep, making sure they were eating correctly, doing, you know, keeping social connections when they felt that they could with other people, incorporating those types of things, asking for assistance when they really felt they were unable to deal with something on their own, keeping in contact regularly with a physician or some type of care provider if there is an official sort of diagnosis, and maybe even regular visits, speaking to someone like a counselor or just a close friend. Those are types of things we talk about when we're looking at ways to build mental health. So those can all exist, and someone can be doing those things regularly every day to keep their mental health at its optimum level while still dealing with something that may be a diagnosed mental illness.
It's like trying to eat salads while you're also living with, you know, a viral infection of some sort in your body, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Great parallel to physical health. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that that's just a much simpler way to conceptualize what health versus illness means when you're talking about the brain, because you can't see what's happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, and again, because I think a lot of that physical health promotion has really been out in our society and has existed out there just for a lot longer than the mental health piece has. So there are a lot of those pieces that already exist that are easier for people to digest and understand if we can draw that parallel with mental health.
So when staff members and administrators and educators learn to identify these different strains of mental illness or how to notice that someone isn't experiencing high mental health, what can they then do to help people? What are they told?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And as part of this training, I should mention it's not UBC specific necessarily. This is sort of a larger overarching piece that allows opportunity to discuss specific resources that might be available or a next plan of action at UBC. With this training, we're really sending a message out there that we're not asking staff and faculty to be counselors. We are absolutely not asking them to diagnose or, you know, anything like that. We're providing them with information so that they can really keep their eyes open and notice observable changes that might be happening in the students and colleagues that they're working with on a regular basis. At that point in time, whether it was a student or a staff and faculty member, there are a few different ways that it might go. On the student side of things, there's been a new green folder for assisting students in distress that has been developed. And so that would be a great resource. It has what to do if it is a high threat or someone is at high risk, medium risk, and low risk in terms of follow through. And the majority of them for students really end with submitting something to the early alert program, which is done through counseling services. And it's a way for staff and faculty to highlight a student that they might be concerned about based on their observations and then have someone from counseling services follow up with that student. On the staff and faculty side, we have an employee and family assistance program, which is a third party confidential counseling service. And we encourage colleagues to let other colleagues know about it, or managers to let their staff and faculty know if they might be concerned about them.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular mental health disorders or mental illnesses that you find are most focused on and most important to notice when you're dealing with students, or is it totally broad swath?
That's a great question. I can't say that I can speak specifically to the UBC population. I do know anecdotally from speaking to folks who work in counseling services or who work out sort of on the front lines with students, is that we do, you know, see a lot of anxiety and depression. Again, those are in our general population base as well. So it's not specific to UBC. It's these tend to be I would say the two most talked about anyways, and the mental health challenges, I guess, that are most widely recognized. So when we do training for staff and faculty through our department, we highlight those two particular mental health challenges. We look at what the signs and symptoms of depression might be, and we look at the signs and symptoms of anxiety. Again, more so based on the general prevalence within our population, and using UBC kind of as a subsect or representation of that population.
To what extent is the university itself becoming more aware and accepting of mental health and mental illness as barriers to learning and performance and participation for students, do you think?
I think it's really becoming something that there's a heightened awareness around. From the work that I've done with the folks that work directly with students on a regular basis, there's a lot of emphasis being placed on the impact of mental health on academic performance. And so how really tying those two things together, because, you know, folks are here to learn. And I think that that's part of the atmosphere that's out here all the time, that really high, intense, high-achieving academic atmosphere. And if we can weave mental health and building mental health into academia, then that will help to bring it in to everything that we're doing out here. And I think it's starting to happen. I've been on campus since 2011, and I would say that even since then, I've really noticed the start of a cultural shift around the way that we talk about mental health, the way that we talk about positive mental health, the way that we address mental health challenges, and really, you know, the university's wider perspective to try and create a caring community where folks are looking out for each other.
Yeah. It's something that you can notice even just in the prevalence of postering and things like having an accessibility collective funded. There's a little bit more emphasis on making sure that the university is an inclusive space for more people than it has been in the past, I think.
Absolutely. And that was why this was such a really interesting application that we put forward. And the Equity and Inclusion Office, I don't think, had ever seen an application quite like ours. But we really made the case that in raising the levels of mental health literacy on campus, we were then creating a more accessible and caring space for people who might be experiencing something like that, and really allowing folks to be recognized and feel validated on campus. And so I think we just have to keep giving people opportunities to learn more. Last week on campus, I was involved in Thrive Week, which is a whole week dedicated to ways to build positive mental health. And I think, you know, events and activities that happened as part of that do the exact same thing in terms of raising that profile.
What were some of the events that you thought were particularly pertinent and on point in terms of the conversation that is most important to be having on campuses right now?
Was that during Thrive Week?
Yes.
Oh, wow. There were so many different ones. I think a lot of our events, we asked our partners to really focus on skill building. That was something we'd heard through our evaluation in the past from students and staff and faculty, was they were sort of aware of mental health and that, yeah, positive mental health was a good thing. But at the end of the day, they said, well, what's the why? What is my takeaway that I can take with me? And so I think in some of the events, there were self-care workshops that were offered during the week, which I think, you know, assessing your stress level, what can you actually do? What does self-care look like for you personally? What can we be doing to, you know, look after ourselves? Physical activity-based events, yoga and Zumba that happened during the week, inviting people to see how they felt mentally after taking part in a physical activity. So I think it was really around giving people the opportunity to try something out that they might be able to use as a skill later on and tuck it away and pull it out when they need it or when their mental health was really sort of under a lot of pressure or under a lot of strain. We also had some panelist events. We had a faculty-specific event where we invited faculty to talk about what well-being means and looks like, as well as some sort of creative. There was a play and a movie and an art exhibition. And so I think just really starting the conversation for people around what mental health means to them personally.
Well, and it's so interesting, the idea of starting a conversation, the idea of first aid in terms of mental health. There's this implication that it's baby steps. It's the very beginning of a much broader conversation. It's almost like the UBC administrators and people participating in this program and people doing work like yourself are first responders and, yeah, the kind of crusaders for this extra level of caring that the university is trying to participate in.
Absolutely. I think being on a campus this large, it's easy to feel quite isolated, or it's easy to feel like you're really here alone and that there's not necessarily a community that you are a part of. There are lots of smaller communities that exist on campus, but we are part of this sort of larger UBC community. And so through programs like this, what we're trying to do is, like you said, really arm the folks who are out there on the front lines working with students to give them the tools to better assist if there was a need. So the groups that we're still targeting coming up this year, hopefully, are campus security, as well as our faculty, and some of the other groups that sort of work directly with students. And again, with the thought in mind that this information through Mental Health First Aid is universal, and it can be applied in your personal life, it can be applied out in the community, and it can be applied right here as well.
Mm-hmm. What brought you into working in promoting health on campus?
Well, actually, when I'm a UBC alumni, and when I was a student here, I was a wellness peer at the Student Wellness Center. I was looking for a way to give back on campus, and that was sort of the avenue that I found. And as I would go out and do educational events and presentations to student groups, I thought, wouldn't it be great if this was a job? Wouldn't it be great if when I grew up and graduated, you know, I could get paid to do this? And so a few years down the line, I discovered that that was a possibility. And health promotion in itself is really growing. And I think people are starting to understand that the more you do on a preventative side, the better off you are in the long run. You know, things may still happen. There'll be physical health and mental health challenges, but the more front loading of information and education we can do for people, then the better equipped they will be if something does come up. Then they know where to go, they know who to talk to, they know what kind of resources are out there.
Definitely. Well, in case anyone is listening in right now who might be struggling with mental health challenges or a mental illness and they're looking for resources, can you give a shout out to a few places to go on campus?
Absolutely. Student resources on campus that are amazing are the Wellness Center, Counseling Services, SASC and Speakeasy, any of our peer wellness or peer coaching programs. Student Health Service as well is out here. And I know I don't work necessarily always on the student realm, so I know I'm forgetting lots. Equity and Inclusion Office, Access and Diversity. But there really is such a wide array out there. And so I think even our Thrive website, so thrive.ubc.ca that we were promoting last week, has a section on resources for students on campus, resources for staff and faculty on campus.
Fantastic. Miranda, thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, not a problem. Thank you for having me.
The Vancouver experimental psych rock band Co-Pilots is releasing their new album Sunstroke on vinyl. Come out for a party on Friday, November 13th at the Biltmore for an avant-garde jazz, punk, psychedelic rock, noise, pop show with special guests Colin Cohen and the Elastic Stars and Calgary's Ghost Keeper, who will be releasing a new 7-inch for the event. Doors open at 7 and the show starts at 8. Check out Co-Pilots on Facebook for all the information.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
Welcome back. The interview that was just played was an interview with Miranda Massey. She's the health promotions coordinator here at UBC, talking about the first aid project. And here is Rocksteady by Pedwell on 101.9 CTRFM.
Tell me, can you speak to God? 'Cause I've one request to be the very best. CITR and Stomp Records proudly present The Real Mackenzies live at the Rickshaw, Friday, November 13th. With extra special guests, The Brains, The Isotopes, Lost Kung Fu Monkeys, and Rude City Riot. Come celebrate Stomp Records' 20th anniversary in style with good music, good friends, and great times. Hit up stomprecords.com for more info, music, and swag.
There are a lot of things you're not allowed to grow in your basement in Vancouver. Vegetables are not one of those things.
SPEC and the YWCA are excited to introduce the Urban Farmer Field School. The UFFS provides hands-on training in sustainable agriculture, small farm business planning, and community food action.
Class instructors are experts in urban agriculture, food systems, and plant mind control. The integrated curriculum is divided between classroom theory and practical learning.
For more information, please visit the interweb and search for Farmer Field School at spec.bc.ca.
Why so sad?
Oh, nothing really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
One, two, three, four.
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about.
See you then.
Well, how do you like it? There's only one word for it.
Welcome back to All Access Pass at CITR 101.9. We're going to switch topics now from mental health initiatives onto the accessibility of music venues in Vancouver. So as we get deeper into the semester and near winter, sure feels like winter today with the gross rain, the heavy fall concert season is upon us. Spencer Williams, a fellow member of the Access Collective, is an avid show patron and goes to as many concerts as possible, apparently even one tonight. So as he gears up for the pre-holiday run of shows, we thought we'd take the time to talk about different venues in the city and let Spencer talk about his personal experiences with their accessibility. So as a wheelchair user, you have experiences at concerts that are often different than other people. Maybe you could share some of those. I know one of the venues you've been to before that many other listeners probably have as well is Rogers Arena. What's it been like for you there?
I'm going to Rogers Arena. It's okay. Can I start again? Going to Rogers Arena, it's cool because they actually have an accessible area on the floor. So I tend to see most of my shows at Rogers Arena from the floor, which is easier now because my chair raises up, so I don't have to stare at people's butts the entire show.
That's probably nice. You get to actually see who you're listening to. What are some of the bands you've seen or artists play at Rogers Arena?
I've seen Kings of Leon. I've seen Metric. I've seen Coldplay. Just too many to name, but definitely one of my favorites has to be Kings of Leon, because I actually got a drumstick from Nathan Followell from Kings of Leon, and that was pretty cool.
That's crazy. That's amazing. I think another time you're going to have to maybe hook me up with some tickets, or tell me how you're getting all the dough to pay for those tickets, because you've been to way more shows than I have. You said before you've also been to the Pacific Coliseum. How's the accessibility there?
The accessibility is phenomenal. I like the Pacific Coliseum because the wheelchair seating, it's closer to the stage, and it's on a raised platform. So, I'm above the crowd, so I can see pretty much everything, and it makes the concert experience that much more enjoyable.
That's awesome. It's really cool to hear that there's places that are considering people that are in wheelchairs and that they are caring about the experience you have too. What's been your experience at the Commodore Ballroom, and who have you seen play there?
My experience at the Commodore Ballroom when going to a show there is I find that I have to show up there before most people if I want to get a good spot. If I show up late, then I'm kind of screwed. It's fine sometimes being squished against the barricade, but you know, it's definitely more enjoyable when I'm right up at the front and no one's touching me. I'm thankful that there's such nice and helpful security at the Commodore, so I don't get that trashed. I've actually seen Frank Turner, he's a British folk artist, British folk country artist, and he's pretty cool. What else?
I think you told me earlier about an experience with the freight elevator. Was that at the Commodore?
Yeah, well,
what's the situation with the freight elevator?
Okay, the freight elevator that I was talking about was at the cellar, which is no longer a venue, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. Like a couple of years back, one of my friends played a show at the cellar, and I'm like, that's bogus. This venue is not accessible. That sucks that I can't go. So I made a fuss about it on Facebook, or the event's Facebook page, and the manager was like, well, wait a minute. Yes, we actually are accessible. We have a freight elevator that you could actually use, and I'll come down and I'll help you down there myself. So that was good to know that they actually cared enough about all their patrons, not just able-bodied patrons, because when it comes down to it, like, it's about filling the venue, and it doesn't matter who goes to these shows. They just some venues just want to make a quick buck, so whatever they can do to help out their patrons, they'll do it. And I just want to thank Christian Eldred, who helped me at the cellar, and now he's now working at the Roxy, and he's made my experience just that much more enjoyable.
Sweet, that's awesome. So you seem to have a really positive outlook on it, and you've had some awesome experiences, which are really, it's really nice to talk about that kind of stuff with accessibility and hear good stories. I just want to go back to the idea, though, of using a freight elevator. You're pretty easygoing about that. but I'm just thinking, like, does this make a difference with using a freight elevator from using a more centralized elevator that you would share with others? Like, does having to use a freight elevator contribute to the notion of, like, second-class citizen when someone's in a wheelchair, or that, you know, their accessibility is an afterthought? I know it's still better than other venues because not every venue even offers an elevator, but how do you feel about that when you're not using kind of the same system that would be accessible to everyone or is, like, front and center?
Just to, in my mind, just as long as the venue has an option. Obviously, it would be nice if they had a regular elevator for me to use, but I don't mind risking my life for my favorite band. I don't mind braving the cold either. Actually, one time I went to see Billy the Kid at the Biltmore, and the Biltmore is not accessible from the front, so I asked the staff where the accessible entrance was, and they said I had to go through the beer fridge.
Oh my gosh.
Where they keep all the kegs and stuff, and going through there was freezing, but I guess,
hope they gave you some free beers on the way.
No, they didn't give me any free beer, which I was kind of pissed off about, but anyway, I'm not a beer drinker, so it doesn't really matter. That was interesting. It was definitely very cold, and very, very, very cold, but I warmed up quite quickly because it can get very stuffy in the Biltmore.
Well, it's good that you were able to warm up and kind of come out of that situation with a good attitude about it. They're really good anecdotes to hear, I think, about how accessibility becomes an issue, or, you know, how you just roll with it in situations. But I think it's also important to just talk about the idea that the accessibility of concerts really ties into just the overall arching theme of accessibility of music and the equity of experience opportunity. So you're talking about your feelings about accessibility from a firsthand experience. What's one improvement that you would love to see in all venues that would enhance your experiences? That could be, like, physical improvements or just, like, social or cultural improvements. One thing that you would love to see change as you go forward into the concert season?
Well, I would just like to see more raised platforms in certain venues, and for them not to be put, like, in the back where I can't see anything. I have no problem raising myself up and, like, driving to the front, but I'd prefer, like, there's some concerts where I don't want to go into the mosh pit.
Yep, that's fair.
If I don't have, you know, if I don't have energy, but, you know, there's shows where I do want to go, and like, but yeah, that's what I would pretty much like to see. I'd also like to see like more like the effort to put in more accessible washrooms at concerts, because that the access to washrooms at certain venues aren't that wheelchair friendly. So yeah, those are the only two improvements I could think of right now.
Yeah, it would be super awesome if we could see those changes happen in the next little while. I know in the next 2 weeks, I'm going to a series downtown at Venue Nightclub, where they're actually putting on a panel to discuss about how to make nightlife in Vancouver more accessible. So hopefully on All Access Pass, we'll be able to review how that went, which will be super sweet. I'm really glad that we can hear that you've had some positive experiences and that you get to enjoy one of the things that you love most in life, which is music, and you've had awesome experiences. But I guess just pointing out to our listeners, they probably can't see, but you have a super sick chair, an electric chair that you can lift yourself up like when you need a better view. Yeah. And like that works most of the time. Not everyone has that as well. Maybe chairs that don't lift up or manual chairs. I could see it maybe would be even a bigger problem for those people. They would maybe struggle or just be frustrated with the accessibility of that. But hopefully changes that'll happen, I like to think that they will happen and not just want them to happen, will fix that for everyone and make that experience really equal. So I know one of the bands that you've seen is Good for Grapes. Could you send us to a song from them?
Actually, before we go to a song, I just want to take a minute and say that I'm going down to see Good for Grapes at the Imperial tonight. Doors are at 8, and first band comes on at 9 o'clock. Good for Grapes are playing with the Wild Romantics, and Good for Grapes is on at 10:30, and tickets are available at the door, and they're $15. Here is
I think just before you introduce the song, we're almost out of time, so I'm just going to reiterate that we really want more people to get involved in the collective. Me and Spencer here are running a pretty sweet show, but we'd like for you to come get involved as well. We're looking for students or community members, and if you're interested, come by the CITR radio station, the lower level of the Student Nest at 6133 University Boulevard in Vancouver. And we hope you enjoy Cursed by the Wind by Good for Grapes.
I feel that I'm cursed by the wind. I feel the chains held under my skin. It blows me down onto the ledge, a place I've grown to love and befriend. Thank you.
From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC